Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. It's great to see so many people. I think it's always a pleasure to have so many interested people coming for interesting lectures. And I can understand because our guest of honor, Sergei Lebedev, is here. The title of his speech, you see it here, After Putin, Russia's Imperial Complex as a Cultural and Political Problem. He will give his lecture in a few minutes. First, let me introduce myself. My name is Kisha Hekster. I work for the Dutch public broadcaster, and I was a Moscow correspondent for a few years, but it's already a long time ago. I'm based now in Brussels, where I cover EU and NATO, among other things, but I think everybody who's involved in Russia shares with me that you can never get it out of your mind. So it's a great honor that I'm your guide for this evening again. Thank you so much, Raam, for asking me, and Rode Hood for organizing this 8 October lezing. Before we ask Sergei Lebedev to hold his lecture, he will be briefly introduced by famous filmmaker Jessica Gorter. I will give you the floor a bit later. And after the lecture, there will be a Q&A. I will ask Sergei some questions over here. And then afterwards, it's your turn, esteemed public, to ask your questions to Sergei Lebedev, so you can already start thinking what's the most pressing question you have on your mind. Let me think what I forgot. Not too much. Today, I think Jessica, please come over here. You all know Jessica Gorter, I guess. She's a famous filmmaker, documentary maker, and also board member of RAM. So we're very happy that you're here to introduce Sergei. And I learned that you met in Russia. And can you explain what you were doing there at that moment?
Yes. So thank you. It's a great privilege to introduce Sergei Lebedev to you. And we met in 2018 in the apartment of Yuri Dmitriev, the historian researcher who was looking for mass graves until he himself was arrested. But in the week that we met, he was still he had already been arrested, but he was allowed to await his verdict at home.
And you made a great documentary about him, and through this documentary, you met Sergei, and you're going to introduce
him. Exactly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, I'd very much like to share an anecdote from my first meeting with Sergei in Yuri Dmitriev's apartment in March 2018. The room we were in was filled with family, friends, and journalists from independent outlets like Novaya Gazeta, Radio Liberty, and BBC Russia, all aware it might be our last chance to speak freely with Dmitriev. The next day, he would face the verdict of an unfair trial with fabricated charges that would most likely result in a lifelong prison sentence. Sergei pulled me aside that evening, and he told me about a video recording that Dmitriev had shown him the night before. Dmitriev had filmed himself with a small camera during his last exhibition to the Solovki Islands in search for unmarked graves of prisoners who perished during the Stalin times. In the image, he primarily focused on the ground in front of him, zooming in on all small details of the soil, talking softly to himself about what he was observing. Sergei clearly was very excited about this material, and he urged me, you must ask him about it, and you must see it, and you can maybe use it for your film, as it reveals how he searches, how he looks, and how he meticulously examines the earth for clues that can help him in his quest finding these people. Back in the Netherlands, I read Oblivion, Sergei Lebedev's first novel, which explores the legacy of the Soviet Union's Gulag. I had not read anything like it before. that connects the unresolved violent past so vividly with the present one. The dark phantom of the past haunting modern Russia became almost tangible. And I suddenly understood why Sergei had drawn my attention to the seemingly insignificant video footage. These images showed Dmitriev utilizing every detail to unlock the past. It became very clear to me what both men share. Layer by layer, they uncover history with all the resources and talents available to them. Both are driven by an unrelenting determination and courage to confront their country's concealed past, where every trace of the perpetrators seemed to have been erased. The fact that Yuri now has spent almost 8 years in prison and Sergei decided to leave his country in 2018 speaks volumes about their bravery with which they do their work. Sergei is remarkable for his willingness to explore all sides of his own family history. Through extensive research, which he has conducted for years and likely continues to do so, he has uncovered a lineage of merchants, priests, and nobility, most of whom perished during the First and the Second World War in the Siege of Leningrad or in the Gulag. He also discovered that his grandmother's second husband was a colonel in the State Security Service and head of a Gulag camp. In his books, he writes about the pain of not knowing, the struggle with guilt, shame, fear, and deep sadness, and how these often subconscious feelings deeply affect modern Russia. He confronts Russians with their repressed past, and he invites his readers to examine their own history and reflect on themselves. He offers us a perspective on what is happening in Russia, but besides helping us to get a better understanding of the current situation and providing context for what is happening, Sergei is a great literary talent. The New York Review of Books praised Lebedev as the best of Russia's younger generation of writers. And next year, his latest novel, The Lady of the Mine, will be published, detailing the early stages of Russia's aggression against Ukraine in 2014 and the downing of flight MH17. It is high time we get to know him better, as his books have been translated into 20 countries, but not yet here in the Netherlands. So we are very honored to have him here with us. Let's give him a warm welcome.
Dear ladies, dear gentlemen, Jessica, all who made this trip possible. Many, many thanks. It's a great honor to stay here. I was actually really surprised by the venue. We are in a hidden church. And I would say that in some sense we are a hidden church. We are preaching the values which are at stake today. Freedom and justice. So let be it. I will start. We are speaking today as we approach the end of the third year of Russia's open military aggression against Ukraine, which the Russian leadership mockingly calls a special military operation. Ukraine's losses, military, demographic, economic, cultural, are staggering and growing by the day. At the same time, the hopes that the Russian aggression would run out of steam, that the economy would fail, that there would be a social explosion, unfortunately, did not materialize. The Russian state proved to be stable enough to continue the war without considering losses. Of course, one could say that the reason is that all opposition structures have been destroyed in advance and that coordinated, sustained public protest is impossible under de facto military dictatorship and police state. This obvious consideration seems to be important, but incomplete. There is another factor that lies at the intersection of social and ethical, a factor that is difficult to measure empirically, but that plays an important role in both Vladimir Putin's internally repressive and externally invasive policies. That factor is extremely low price of human life in Russia. I'm not so much talking about conventional economic value on which insurance companies operate. Although money does play a role. I'm talking about the combination of civil rights and dignity that gives rise to the idea of self-worth and inviolability of the individual. I'm talking about the symbolic, but at the same time very real value of life, which is expressed, among other things, in the institutions of law, in the institution of independent court, and in the way the state protects the lives of the people, for example, in extreme situations. Metaphorically speaking, Vladimir Putin has now a supply of these cheap lives, which Russian command can spend paying them for kilometers of advance deep into the Ukrainian territory. It is these lives, not just shells, equipment, fuel, and money, that are the main currency of this war. Yes, now money is also at stake. Those who sign a contract with the Ministry of Defense can receive a sum maximum at about 50,000 euros. This is a huge amount of money for the Russian province, but the very fact that the lives of citizens can be bought for a certain price showed that these lives have no symbolic, immutable, dignity-related value. Everything is determined by demand and the structure of the war market. Where does this scarcity, this devaluation of existence come from? Without seeking excuses, without trying to rationalize Russian aggression, I still want to understand the question posed, because it has a direct bearing on the political future of Russia. I will focus on three pillars of Putin's new empire, the most important ones from my point of view: impunity, militarism, and chauvinism. Impunity. What is the most horrible about the Soviet project from the perspective we are discussing? It is the monstrous, senseless, criminal waste of human life, which reached such a scale that the life was devalued. I'm not just talking about Stalin's repressions and deportations of entire people, of entire nations, mass shooting, arrests, and the Gulag. The very atmosphere of unfreedom, subjugation, suppression of natural vital interests, destruction of diversity is also a murder. And it is not by chance that even in Russia in August and December 1991, no one really came out to defend the USSR. No one went to the barricades. Most people, it seems to me, had the feeling that it was impossible to live like this, at least in a purely material, utilitarian sense. But how can this notion of value of individual life can be recovered, restored, regrown, and made effective in politics? At the very least, it is necessary to recognize the problem in its entirety, to diagnose it and propose remedies. This has not been done in the case of Russia. Intellectually and anthropologically, Russian liberals were not prepared to understand what the totalitarian legacy is, what power it has, and why the task of restoring violated human dignity and the rule of law and the human rights was a momentous importance for Russia, the center of empire for many centuries. To put it crudely, the bet was on the notorious invisible hand of market. Push the country into the market relations as quickly as possible, and the market will do everything itself. The market will re-educate people, the market will give birth to a new man, an idea very much in the spirit of early Soviet re-education projects. The problem is that if the market itself produces values, there are material values. The market, especially in the form of wild capitalism as it existed in Russia at the time, is not a fertile ground for the growth of civil rights. There was a hope, I remember this motif very well in public discussion, that the class of owners was about to emerge, and this owners, small and large, would become a new political class. Property will give rise to the rights. Property will give rise to dignity. As we can now see, this hope was extremely naive. And it seems to me that the main political question of the transition to the state, based on the rule of law, the question without the solution of which the transition could not take place from the very beginning, was the question of legal and moral responsibility for the numerous and systematic crimes of the Soviet state. The only way to restore the value of the individual life, civil rights and dignity, was to act in two ways: to commemorate the victims, to bring them back from their oblivion, and and this is an extremely important end, to punish the criminals who committed these crimes, to punish them by the legal means, thus restoring the rule of law and stating unequivocally that a human life is indeed invaluable. If justice is not done, any remembrance remains in the air. It does not change the structure of the society. It does not tangibly, visibly prove that the value of human life is an active political value. But what happened in Russia? The question of justice and responsibility was simply pushed aside and replaced by a war concept of repentance, which does not require legal action. Even the most and best liberal minds somehow avoided it, focusing more on memorialization. Some may argue that legal punishment is not an unconditional part of the transition to freedom, pointing to Spain, for example. But the thing is that Spain's relapse to tyranny would have been primarily danger to Spain itself. Russia falling back to the tyranny and de facto questioning, revising the dissolution of the Soviet Union, such Russia is a threat to the whole world. I see the clear connection between the impunity of the Soviet crimes and criminals and Russia's aggression against Ukraine. A country where the crimes of the past go unpunished is an easy prey for the next dictator, precisely because the value of a human life as a public good has not been restored and protected. And so the ground is prepared for the next abuse of power. At best, such society would be guided by the individual survival strategy, where a person values his own life, but not the lives of others. It is a great pity that Russian opposition has never really made Putin's responsibility for aggressive wars the main accusation against him, preferring to focus on corruption in order to gain popular support. The rise of militarism has not been sufficiently recognized because of this. But where does today's Russian militarism come from? Where are its roots? Or, to put it another way, what fuels or drives it? I would dare to suggest that it's not just the crazy wheel of Vladimir Putin and his entourage. The origin is somehow embedded in the very political system of the Russian Federation. What is now Russia is actually a conglomerate of nations that were conquered and subjugated in a different historical periods. Some quite recently, in the middle of the 19th century, under Soviet rule, the larger ones were given quasi-political subjectivity in the form of autonomous republics. More than 30 years ago, one of these republics claims independence. It was Chechnya. The Chechens were brutally conquered in the 19th century, and the history of the brutal conquest remains a blank spot in Russian public conscience. In 1944, the whole nation was deported to Kazakhstan with enormous population losses. Quite a record, one might say, quite a pattern to prove and explain the claim of independence. First, Russia tried to overthrow the Chechen government by sending troops with no insignia, pretending to be opposition. Then, in December 1994, came a full-scale army assault. The operation was planned to be short and victorious. Russian generals did not believe they would meet resistance. As we all know, the operation had grown into big war, into punishment campaign against rebellious nation. Destroyed cities and facilities, use of heavy weapons to scare the population and force into submission, mass crimes against civilians. All that we see now in Ukraine was already a reality 30 years ago. Simply put, the Russian government under Yeltsin had sent an example for other potential candidates. No one goes, everyone stays. One can discuss the general legal framework, the international law that prevents separatism and gives central governments the power to respond. But the law cannot eliminate reality. And the reality is that the question of the right of nations to self-determination is one of the key questions for the future of Russia. It will always be on the table, even if we pretend that it's not there. The war, waged for the sake of integrity of the state and constitutional order, turned the very state it was supposed to save into the reincarnation of the Russian Soviet Empire with its brutal colonization policies. And it reintroduced militarism as a permanent state of alert, as a violent way of dealing with emancipatory tendencies by suppressing them with a military force. The Russian word raspad, which means collapse, dissolution, became the main political bugaboo as early as the 90s. Any attempt to discuss the design of the so-called federation, the distribution of rights within it, to raise the idea of secession, even as theoretical possibility, could easily have been blocked with the accusation, do you want the bloody collapse of Russia or what? It's quite interesting psychologically that underneath the public consciousness, there is a non-verbal assumption that the Russian Federation is not exactly the most attractive state to be the part of. And if given free will, nations will immediately rush out. Somehow the majority of Russians assume that Russia is actually quite a precarious, unstable political structure, and it needs stricter rule, it needs repression as a tool of maintenance, otherwise it will collapse. This fetish of integrity and the fear of collapse can be seen as a historical doom of Russia. In 1917, the empire collapsed, and literally hundreds of protest states emerged. Poland, Finland, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia escaped. Others were taken back by force during the Civil War. Then, in 1939, almost simultaneously, Poland and Finland were attacked. Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia were forced into negotiations, which resulted in the loss of independence in 1940. After the Second World War, the new layer of satellite states in Eastern Europe were taken under the Soviet control. When the Soviet Union again collapsed in the 1989-1991, again the new states emerged, gaining international recognition, and some of the Russian republics had shown sovereign ambitions. In August 1990, future President Boris Yeltsin made a famous statement to the public in Kazan, the capital of the Tatar Autonomous Republic. You can take as much sovereignty as you can swallow. And he added, but you are in the center of Russia. Do not forget that. 4 years later, he will approve the military attack on Chechnya. In 1999, his successor Vladimir Putin opens the gates to the Second Chechen War and shortly thereafter begins to curtail the rights of the subjects of the Federation, including the right to elect governors. In 2008, Russia attacked Georgia, the former Soviet Republic in the Caucasus. 6 years later, it annexed Crimea and invaded, pretending not to, Eastern Ukraine. It is a third expansionist wave in a period of a century. As if this structure really cannot stand still, it can either disintegrate or collapse or reassemble and expand. In a way, it cannot. The logic of internal centralization of power to avoid imaginary dissolution creates attraction, a kind of overproduction of power to be channeled outward. And the historical and cultural neighborhood of the former empire creates a perfect playground for the historically justified claims, provides a set of myths that can be politically instrumentalized and used to exercise dominance. There is another side, or rather a long-term effect of these waves of expansion and militarization, which are engraved in Russian culture as symbols of power and glory. Public peace movements and pacifism are a characteristic feature of the Western political landscape. In Russia, pacifism, which tends to emphasize the value of a human life, I would say is somehow a foreign concept, known but not widely practiced. I can share with you my personal experience, which I am not certainly proud of. In 1999, I was drafted to the Russian army. Just a detail, the draft notice was printed on the blank of the Ministry of Defense of the Soviet Union, 8 years after it ceased to exist. So officially, I was called to join the ranks of the Soviet army. I avoided the draft because of fearing of ending up in Chechnya. There was a whole then generation of draft dodgers in the big cities. Very rarely did a young boy in our circles want to go. We were good at fooling the military commissars, but we were young, and it was still Yeltsin's time, when huge demos were possible, mass strikes were possible. But no one, literally no one, thought of protesting, of making a student movement against the war, against the draft, or movement for peace. It was not just a lack of courage or experience. It was a contradiction to something not codified, but rather tangible. The built-in aggressive masculinity of everyday Russian culture, with its hidden obsession with hierarchy, power, dominance, with the omnipresence of heroic cult of World War II, in which we had grown up. To admit being a pacifist, a peace seeker, was something embarrassing, almost indecent. One more argument to be added here. In the 90s, nuclear disarmament was on the way, since the Cold War was presumably over. But there was no political party or movement, no substantial public group that consistently demanded such disarmament. The last public figure who approached the problem of weapons of mass destruction from a fundamental ethical point of view was the academician Andrei Sakharov, the father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb, who became a human rights activist and a liberal thinker, and who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1975 for his struggle for human rights in the Soviet Union, disarmament and cooperation between all nations. With his death at the end of 1989, the whole discourse was about the danger of nuclear weapons was swept away from the public discussion in Russia, as it had never been before. The only visible public concern was that the nuclear weapons are aging and rusting. But what is the nuclear arsenal? It's a multiplier of a civic responsibility for the citizens of a country that owns it. We have never put it this way. Why? Again, I think because the very idea of disarmament sounds suspicious to the Russian ear. It takes a lot of courage to disarm, to build trust and respect, and we have always lacked such trust. Because, as a writer, I can say things political scientists cannot. Because Russia is built on the fear of losing itself, of falling apart. Because none of us can explain absolutely convincingly what holds us, different nations, together, except inertia, the violence of the past, and the rigid, inflexible political architecture inherited from the Soviet Union. We are obsessed with the fetishes of power because it's compensatory. In fact, we are powerless in our own country, not knowing what vision of the future we have. The project, the Soviet project, was at least formally oriented towards the future. It offered at least some false, but great, at least given, explanations for the common goals of the multi-ethnic community. This project was designed to be modern, to be a vehicle from the dark past to the rich future. And it's no coincidence that Vladimir Putin has, in a way, reversed an era of time. His project uses some Soviet spare parts, but in its core, it's aimed to the past, to the golden age. It's conservative and archaic. It thrives on the variety of fears that social progress triggers. And one of the characteristics of this project is a growing chauvinism. You cannot oppose modernity without a return to imperial paternalism, the flip side of which the chauvinism is. When I tell people in the West that Russia is a chauvinist and racist country, most of them do not believe me or say that I'm exaggerating. Russians, even liberal ones, do not support this thesis or would accept it partially. Yes, there are certain attitudes towards the people from Caucasus, towards the workers from Asia, but I want to talk about government policy, not public opinion, about the ongoing covert process that the famous Ukrainian dissident and philosopher Ivan Zhuba, who was severely prosecuted by the Soviet KGB for his views, called denationalization, which means the deliberate erasure of national identity by means of Russification, education and memory policies, employment models, and so on. Approximately every fifth person in the Russian Federation is not actually Russian. It's a lot of people, more than 20 million, more than you have in Netherlands in total. But, as I have already said, they are de facto do not have political subjectivity. Their different historical narratives are not represented on the federal level. We all have learned Russia's history from the Moscow point of view within the logic of the colonizer. It's a very comfortable model for the Russians. Nothing disturbs your conscience. Nothing reminds you about the bloody history. Their languages are going extinct. Experts told me there are approximately from 8 to 10 non-Russian languages in Russia capable of producing modern prose and poetry. But soon the count will be 7 and then 6. Since 2018, according to the federal law signed by Mr. Putin, the teaching of the native languages in schools has lost its obligatory status. This means that the next generation will know much less and will be cut off from their ancestors. To protest this decision, Udmurt scholar and language activist Albert Razin committed a self-immolation in vain. All this can be seen as a problem of globalization, as said, but somehow natural process in a modern world. But it's not. It's a chosen path. It's an active and poisonous political paradigm, which, coupled with a long imperial and colonial history, gives the Russian public reasons to believe that there are subordinate nations, nations that are not entitled to the statehood, because if given one, they will go off rails and become a threat to Russia. This is exactly the concept, one of them, widely used by Russian propaganda to justify Russian aggression against Ukraine. Independent Ukrainian statehood is described as a permanently failed state, a puppet of the West manipulated to harm Russian interests. Put another way, Russia's imperial and colonial history, which is not reflected upon, criticized, and discarded, creates a potential security alert for all states that were once part of the empire. This history offers tropes of former unity, powerful images of predestined togetherness, stealthily stealing sovereignty, turning independent states and nations into satellites designed to follow Russia's lead. It can be used for internal purposes, eliminating attempts at emancipation, and it can be directed outward, as in the case of Ukraine, explaining why this particular territory is not considered for self-government. When the Ukrainian authorities demolished Soviet-era monuments erected almost automatically in every city, such as statues of Lenin and Pushkin, the latter case sometimes provokes grim comments from the Russian intellectual community. What does Pushkin have to do with the war? Why should the monuments of a great poet be destroyed? People do not feel that they are in a way interfering and trespassing. But trespassing is not the main point. The Pushkin statues were erected as a sign of ownership and dominance, as a symbol of undisputed superiority of Russian culture, as a fraternal reminder of who is who. So it's up to the Russian intellectuals to work through this difficult subject, to reveal the true nature of the Russian expansion, and to understand how Russian culture itself was and still is instrumentalized as a tool of Russian state chauvinism, of forcible Russification. What kind of a perspective do we have in the view of above? The future is certainly not bright today. But when and if the day of reckoning comes for Russia, it would be very important to learn the lessons of the 90s, when the most urgent and valuable opportunities were not even considered. The most urgent thing would be to restore justice and punish war criminals. Unfortunately, we shouldn't be too optimistic in this regard. The ongoing war of aggression is creating a completely different political and moral landscape from that of the perestroika period. Millions of people are directly involved in the war effort: military personnel, defense and transportation workers, members of the families. The whole law enforcement system is being used to round up and suppress dissent. This creates a vouchsafing bond that will be very difficult to break. I do not believe that even in the best case scenario, Russian liberals will have enough political leverage to enforce justice, restore the rule of law, and punish even the most heinous criminals. I suspect that they will tactically opt for silence, avoiding or postponing the question of responsibility. And all the more important would be the role of Ukrainian Western allies who would have such leverage, at least economically, in the form of sanctions currently imposed on Russia and its frozen assets. Any deal, any agreement on lifting sanctions should be inextricably linked to the implementation of a transitional justice package, the content of which should be formulated and discussed with Ukraine. If the Russian opposition really needs anything from the Western democracies, it is a firm stand and a moral clarity. You will not get a free pass a second time. Our support would and should be conditional. Justice, restoration of borders, and compensation for Ukraine. In my view, this is the only sticking point that can really make a difference. And the more leverage the Ukrainian allies would have, the greater the difference could potentially be. Unfortunately, it's a bit early as well to discuss Russia's possible demilitarization, but the same logic applies here. Economic ties in exchange for disarmament and stopping the supply of arms and military technology to the tyrants around the globe. Russia is not just attacking Ukraine. It is increasing the risk for many other countries, providing the enemies of the free world with unknown and known offensive capabilities, just as USSR did in earlier times. And it should be said loud and clear, no deals until Russia abandons its policy of global destabilization and cuts its ties with the proxies. The semi-comical KPSU trial in the early 90s exposed some of the Soviet foreign connections of this kind, but these were not considered really dangerous by Democrats. As a result, we now live in a world where Stalin's foreign policy still contributes to Russia's war, with China's unilateral neutrality and North Korea's direct involvement. This is a very concrete Stalinist legacy in action, and it cannot be defeated by some cultural strategies. Secret agreements should be exposed and broken. Foreign policies should be reversed, leaving no room for ambiguities and double games. And there is another example that Europe can set, since the Russian opposition seems incapable of setting it itself. There should be no discussion about Russia's political future without the voices and positions of non-Russian Russians, who are obviously underrepresented and marginalized. Even the best and most knowledgeable experts are used to look at Russia through the lens of the Russian language, Russian culture, and Russian history. But I dream of the day when this monopoly will be actively challenged. And here, you will have a Tatar intellectual or an Edmort intellectual or a Dagestani intellectual talking about his or her views on the Russian imperial complex. I can assure you that this would be a hard experience because Russia's nations are being diminished by Putin's regime and at the same time used in a traditional colonial way as a source of manpower for aggression against Ukraine, thus creating complicity and hampering future attempts at emancipation. I would like to add a small postscript to this speech related to the Netherlands. In May 1938, two men met at the Hotel Atlanta at Rotterdam. One was Yevhen Konovalets, military leader of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, known as OUN. The second was, in fact, an infiltrated Soviet agent, high-ranking operative Pavel Sudoplatov, born in Melitopol. He gave his counterpart a box of chocolates, as if it were a gift from Ukraine. The box was a time bomb made in a secret police laboratory. Moscow wanted Konovalets, the staunch supporter of Ukrainian independence, dead. A few minutes later, as Konovalets was leaving the hotel and passing the movie theater, the bomb went off. Konovalets was killed instantly. Pavel Sudoplatov later murdered several other prominent figures of Ukrainian national movement, including Bishop Theodore Romža, who received a little injection while being in hospital. Why remembers the plot of story today? When Melitopol was occupied by Russian troops in 2022, the occupiers immediately erected a monument to him and renamed the street after him. More recently, a week ago, a head of a Russian foreign intelligence service, Sergei Naryshkin, proposed to rename Talinskaya Street in Moscow, which was named after the capital of Estonia during Soviet rule, in honor of Sudoplatov. Thus, Moscow praises Stalin's trusted hitman, whose specialty was to eliminate national resistance movements. It's a bravado of the criminal who enjoys his impunity. But there is another place, another city in the Netherlands, whose name is a symbol of justice. I wish that one day Vladimir Putin will find himself in Haag, on the bench where he definitely belongs.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your very inspiring lecture. You need some water.
Yes.
Yes, after such a long lecture. Let me give it to you.
Thank you. Yeah, just one sip.
Thank you. You take a breath?
No.
You're fine?
Let's go.
Thank you. Yeah, it's, as I was saying, it was really very inspiring. I have so many questions. The first thing that struck me maybe was that you rarely hear such a harsh and radical criticism on Russia from Russians, obviously because this is dangerous and it takes bravery to say this. And I was wondering, who do you have still some examples, people that you value a lot in Russia or Russians abroad that share your views? Who are those people?
Some of them are dead for a long period. It's quite a tough question, actually. It's not easy to answer.
But are there still people who share your views inside Russia, outside of you, or
okay, the communication lines are broken, really. You really cannot say what the people in Russia feel or think. Even if you have a very trusted contact, it's about technicalities. It's about how you communicate. You cannot just call and talk about all the things. I would say that Jessica started with Yuri, and I will proceed with Yuri. He's maybe the most important person for me who is now in Russia, in captivity, in the prison camp, which is exactly the Gulag camp. It's the same place, the same structure. Why him? Why exactly this person? He did something very specific. The search for the grave sites, for the killing sites, is not an easy, it's not a safe thing to do. Most of the commemoration places, which are now well known, which are close to the big cities in Russia, they were not found by anyone. They were revealed by the state security itself in the late 80s, early 90s. As a part of democratization of security forces, he did something which was not done before. He went and found the places which were not given up by the state security. And the most interesting thing, what he did with them, because usually we have a tendency to build, I don't know, one monument, one piece which commemorates everyone. he turned this execution site, which is really a huge forest, into the place of different memories. In the Sandermoog, this cold place is called Sandermoog, people of approximately 55, 60 nations were executed. And he invited the representative of every nation to join, to build their own monuments. In a way, he deciphered the very structure of national repressions in the Soviet Union. And what makes Sandermoog really special? There is a very special historical notion. It's called an executed renaissance. Sandermoog is extremely important place for Ukraine because the whole bunch of Ukrainian cultural elite from the 30s were first accused of nationalism, arrested, sent to the Solovki camp with their sentences from 3 to 5, 6 years. But then the decision was made to execute them in 1937. For Ukrainian culture, for Ukrainian language, for Ukrainian theater, literature, poetry, this is the place of the most terrible loss ever. They are all there. And this is not a coincidence that Dmitriev case happened after Russia invaded Ukraine in 2014. Because before, it was a Ukrainian delegation in Sandermoog with the Ukrainian flags singing Ukrainian songs. But this was not possible after 2014 because it established the direct pattern, the direct link of violence between the two times. And it was necessary to erase this memory, to shut the Sandermoog down. And this what explains for me what had happened to Yuri. And he contributed by his research to Ukrainian national cause, to Ukrainian understanding. He found the fallen Ukrainian cultural best actors of the 20s, 30s, and so on. This is an example, and this is actually what we all should have done. But he was, and he is still alone.
He's still alone, you say?
This is the very special type of the person who knows the archival work, who knows how to search in the field, and who is really obsessed in finding the final places, not with the symbolical commemoration techniques or, I don't know, artistic concepts. He wants to find the actual last place of death. And this is pretty unusual, I would say.
You contribute in your way by giving lectures, by publishing. I was wondering if there is still, you say it's very easy to communicate with people in Russia.
Not
of course,
easy, vice versa.
And vice versa. But is there still some people who, like you, are thinking about how to radically change Russia?
Is it honestly serious? I will not name them from the public scene.
No, not from name, but just
which
to
is,
give an idea.
Broadcasted into the internet.
No, but just for us to give an idea of whether this is still alive. Is it still possible?
Okay, I would say that there is a conventional Russian opposition, which is gathering on the congresses, discussing certain things. I wouldn't be too much insulting, but this is mostly the white males of my age or older, with the several women present to show the presence of the women, and with very few representatives of any other nation than Russian. I think it's just a broken concept.
You're critical about the opposition?
Yes, and I do know that there are other things going on.
Like?
I do know that there are other things going on.
But do you mean other...
Other processes, other structures are on the way.
There's people like you?
There are people like me or people like not me, but some things should be built from the scratch. And, I mean, we are not in the, let's say, normal situation discussing cultural things. Half of my friends, I mean, sorry, are operating undercover. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of, I mean, let's take a, I don't know, time machine and travel 80 years back. Did you discuss, I mean, do you have a fellow either conspirators? Yes, I do. But this is, it's not the proper moment to discuss this, because really the price for any stupid word told from the public scene, for any name given, could be tremendous.
No, I'm not asking about names.
And
obviously,
this is why you cannot say certain things. You simply cannot. But I do know that this thing about the Russian, non-Russian nations, yes, people are organizing. People are trying to to raise this question at least. I hope that something will grow out of this, but it's really too early to say, because they are challenging literally 300 years of Russian history. You cannot change things in a moment.
You criticize liberal Russian opposition. You did it in a speech. I've been reading an article, a long article you wrote this summer in Liberties, also about Alexei Navalny. This was published after his death. On the one hand, you pay tribute to him, to his bravery. On the other hand, you also criticize him for, as you say in the lecture, not telling the Russian public about all the war crimes that have been committed about these centuries of...
Not necessarily centuries.
Mm-hmm. Not about this long period of impunity. And then on the other hand, concentrating on corruption. Do you think that this might be a strategy of him?
Yes, of course it was a strategy. It was not an accidental thing. Of course it was...
Can you explain this strategy?
I mean, corruption is the issue which can easily touch everyone. It doesn't require, I don't know, high moral stand or interest. It's this money is stolen from everybody's pockets. And for me, the very choice of this strategy is very illustrative and very evident, I would say. Because it's clear that already in the first decade of the Putin's rule, Putin was a war criminal. He was. You need to just open any yearly account of Human Rights Watch related to Chechnya and look about ethnic cleansing, about the improvised concentration camps and so on. You cannot in any sense balance this with the corruption accusation. It just cannot be so. This is the crimes against the human lives. The count was immense. And if in any normal way of ethics, you should talk about this first and then talk about the stolen money and whatsoever. But it's very clear that if someone talks about Chechnya, he immediately becomes unpopular. He loses every bit of support this person has, because this war and these crimes are widely denied or thrown out